Hey guys, how's it going?
Oh yeah, no, don't worry, I'm here.
Welcome to the show. It's the Scott Horton Show. I named it that because that's my name. Happy New Year again to you. I got to say that last Friday, but maybe you didn't tune in last Friday. Can you believe it's already the future again, still? 2015. Okay, so, good show lined up for you today. I think. You know. Speaking of the future, I don't really know, but it's a pretty safe assumption that the show will be good today because I'm going to talk with Boyd Cathy. And I've never spoken with Boyd Cathy before, but he wrote this really interesting thing about the Putin there for uns.com. And I didn't run it on antiwar.com because and a little of the cultural conservative stuff got a little beside the point to me. I don't know. Maybe I should have ran it. I don't know. But anyway, there's some really important stuff in there anyway. And important perspective. So Boyd Cathy is going to be on. Get this. He used to be the assistant to Russell Kirk, the author of The Conservative Mind, the founder of modern American conservatism, really. Not Buckley. Well, I guess there's different definitions of really. Maybe it is Buckley after all, but anyway, so that's interesting. Boyd Cathy, writing at uns.com. And then Jason Ditz is going to be on. I was trying to line him up to do the final debunking on all this North Korea stuff last week, so it's going to be a little bit beside the point now, but let's go ahead and get it straight for the record, okay? And in fact, I saw today on the TV, they're still lying, basically. Well, you know, we think the North Koreans paid these guys to do it. Why? Just because you already said North Korea something? Give me a better reason than that to believe that. Eh? I don't know. And I admit I haven't been paying close enough attention, but that's why I'm going to ask Jason, because he knows everything. So Jason Ditz, news.antiwar.com for all the bad news there. And then last week we had a little bit of a communication problem with Beltrue last Friday, and that interview did not come through. But we're all set for today. And she's got this great piece in Foreign Policy. You know, this is mostly my own stupid fault. But I just do not know where to get real good journalism about Libya on a regular basis. Well, she's got some. And I've spoken with her about Libya before. And but this article is just really something else as far as who all is who and who's fighting for what and how much relative strength they have and all these most important questions. She covers it all. It's in there. It's at Foreign Policy. The headline is just a quote, probably not even correct. A ground invasion of the capital is imminent. That's the title of the article. But so go look at that. I'll pull that up during the break or whatever. Beltrue will be on the show. Okay, and so now yesterday, you may or you may not have heard the KPFK show on 90.7 FM in Los Angeles. I played, I record them on Saturday. I mean, sometimes it's best of from this show, but usually I try to record something fresh for KPFK. But since I'm in Austin and they're in LA, I got to record it on Saturday, and then it plays Sunday morning. Trying to get a better time slot. It's been a little while since I talked to this guy. I need to try. Anyway, I interviewed Reese Ehrlich, the author of Inside Syria, which is in my Amazon shopping cart right now. I don't think I hit the button yet because I got to pay the rent first and figure out how much money I have. But anyway, Inside Syria. And I really like Reese. He's a really smart guy. I have not been a regular reader of his work for very long, but every time I do read something by him, it's really good. And you might know him if you ever saw that video of me at the panel discussion thing in 2010, taking on that neocon Greenfield, I think his name was, from some Israel lobby group in L.A. or in Orange County there. That was at UC Riverside, and the real actual occasion of the event was Reese Ehrlich gave a speech. And then There was a panel discussion afterwards, and I was part of the panel discussion afterwards. But anyway, so he's good on Iran and whatever. He's good on the whole Middle East. He's written more than a handful of books about the Middle East, and really seems to know what he's talking about. And I got a hell of a good interview out of him, too. So you can go find that. Oh, actually, you know what? We're having FTP problems. It may not even be at scotthorton.org right now. Until I can get Sneaker on the phone. Sneaker in the chat room today? Hey, Sneaker. Well, it says he's in there. Hey, Sneaker, man. You got to call me. I got problems still. Yeah, no Cardin is the latest one on the site. So, sorry. Soon, though. Soon. In fact, you can hear it at kpfk.org. They keep archives there. So you can pull up my archive there. But anyway, so that's the great Reese Ehrlich, and the link will be at antiwar.com/interviews. And it was a pretty good overview of the war on the Islamic State. And you know what? Let me talk about that right now. So my first question for him was, who's right, War Nerd or Coburn? On one side, and Margulies is with War Nerd on this, that ISIS is a bunch of hooey, and don't you worry about them. They're just another pathetic militia of... lunatics, madmen, but with no real power and no ability to sustain themselves for the long term, et cetera, et cetera. And their numbers are probably wildly overestimated, this kind of thing. On the other side, you have Patrick Coburn, who, you know, no war propagandist, is saying, hey, look, these guys, and joining Coburn, I think Prothero, you could put in the same camp with him. And actually, about halfway through reading Loretta Napoleoni's book, and she certainly presents the Islamic State as a major challenge here. And so I asked Reese, well, so whose side are you taking there? And so he decided to answer by saying, well, I'll do it short, medium, and long term. In the short term, ISIS is very dangerous. The Islamic State is very dangerous to the people nearby. They do not have the ability to field terrorists in an international network Al-Qaeda kind of way, like Al-Qaeda could have back in the day anyway. Not that they really can now. So, you know, and they got their hands full trying to establish a state over there. But so in the short term, hey, they're taking territory and mostly hanging on to it in places where they take it. And they do have, you know, high tens of thousands of fighters recruited now. And et cetera, et cetera. On the other hand, it's not really the usual way of doing things there in Iraqi Sunnistan, and there's no real reason to believe that they will be any more welcome as the long-term rulers of the people there than they were back when they were al-Qaeda in Iraq in 2006 and 2007, when the local Sunni population turned on them and said, you know what? You're not a help to us. You're actually just, you know, pissing us off. And we're the ones who are from here, not you. And so the tribal leaders and just the local population turned on them. Now, things are different now. And he conceded that. But he just said they have no, in terms of their relative strength to AQI back in 06. But in terms of their long-term, prospects for maintaining power, maintaining the consent of the governed in any sense, there's no real reason to believe that they'll have it. And at the same time, they're surrounded by enemies too. And he didn't mention, but I like to mention, they'll never be recognized. Even, you know, Qatar and Saudi and Pakistan recognized the Taliban back in the 90s. No one will ever recognize the Islamic State as the legitimate government of Iraqi Sunnistan there and or in Syria either, as far as the international community. Give them a UN seat, open up trade relations, open up open markets in oil. They'll be under total sanction and total isolation and blockade. And the oil, the only money they'll be making really is black market oil, which is, you know, they've got to cut prices to undercut the open market, and it's limited. Oops, and I talked into the break, and I didn't know it. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. Sorry, I should have done the stretching and yawning during the break. Okay, so Tsarnaev's going on trial. They're picking the jury. The Boston bombing case. I think what I need to do, I guess right before or right after I take care of this gigantic pile of books I'm behind on, is I need to read everything that Cade Crockford ever wrote about the Boston thing. I really like her. I think she's just about as sharp as hell, and she's from Boston, and she's paid very close attention to this case that I haven't paid very close attention to all this time. And I don't know if she knows everything about it, but she certainly seems to pay lots of attention to the things that the government claims that don't seem quite to add up. And on the other hand, I've read a lot of crap looking for good analysis, good revisionist kind of critical analysis of the Boston bombing. I find a lot of complete nonsense, too, and I just ain't got time in my life. So I'm going to outsource it to Cade. I'm going to interview her again. You might remember I interviewed her just a couple of few weeks ago about the murder of Todashev, who was the friend and alleged for a time, but now not anymore, co-conspirator with the elder Tsarnaev brother in the supposed murder of these pot salesman? I don't know. Marijuana businessmen, as Lou Rockwell calls them. I don't know. But I do know that they were trying to murder this kid when he did not have a gun, and they did not have any reason to believe that he was armed. But they found out he was in that boat, which, by the way, they only found out because the guy broke the lockdown order to go out to his backyard to smoke a cigarette. Good thing the Democrats didn't find out about that, huh? They'd have killed him. Smoking a cigarette in your own backyard. Who do you think you are? What do you think this is? When you're on lockdown. So anyway, he went out in the backyard and said, hey, the tarp on my boat seems out of place. Maybe I'll call the cops. So the cops came, and they filled that boat with as many bullet holes as they could make their guns fire, basically. And the kid miraculously survived. But then remember, they lied. They just straight up lied and said, oh yeah, he tried to kill himself. He shot himself in the throat. And that's why nobody can talk to him. And that's why we got to keep him in isolation on this medical thing and this and that. But that was a total lie. So I don't know what else they were lying about there. I think that, I don't know. I'm not the biggest Russ Baker fan. But I think when he says, look, you know, the FBI is constantly recruiting Muslims and trying to turn them into radicals and set them up for crimes. So the possibility that they tried to do that to the elder Tsarnaev brother and that the attack is actually the culmination of that, or his, you know, backlash, blowback, backdraft type reaction. You know, Ted Kaczynski was not an MK Ultra mind control slave doing those bombings. He was blowback from MKUltra. They tortured him. They gave him acid, but then they treated him like, I don't know exactly what they did to him, but they treated him horribly while he was tripping on a mega dose of LSD, and they ruined his complete life. And that's what turned him into a serial mail bomber. So these things happen. It's just we would like to see the law apply to the cops who ever had a relationship like that with this Boston bomber held accountable for whatever they did, if they did. After all, this is America, right? Truth and justice and the rule of law and all of that stuff. Accountability. The whole truth and nothing but the truth. Though the heavens fall and all of that. I don't know. Well, anyway, One Cade is her Twitter handle. Privacy SOS is her blog. Privacy SOS. And she's with the ACLU of Massachusetts. Cade Crockford, again, is her name. One Cade on Twitter. A coercive technique. And anyway, so I plan on interviewing her. That's all I'm really announcing to you. I'm planning on interviewing her about this case as much as I can, because I think she's got a good head on her shoulders about it. That's all. Now, so here's the thing she tweeted this morning about it, which is sort of a change of subject. Quoting from CNN, among the evidence prosecutors are expected to use against Tsarnaev are statements claiming he made, I guess they mean to say, claiming he to be angry at U.S. wars that killed Muslims in Afghanistan and Iraq. So, of course, a couple of things there. As she says, like a lot of people who aren't terrorists, that's evidence of his terrorism, was that he claimed to be angry about America's wars in the Middle East. That certainly does apply to a lot of people who aren't terrorists. And being the civil libertarian that she is, Bland, that's the first thing that jumps out at her. But then Greenwald said, well, so wait a minute. Does this mean that the U.S. government is officially claiming in court for the record that blowback is the cause of terrorist attacks, or at least this one against the United States? That it's not about a promise of virgins in heaven? That it's not a hatred that women can wear mini skirts to vote in primary elections? But it's the fact that the American government slaughters Muslim people to death all day, every day, for decades on end. That is could possibly have anything to do with motivating terrorists? What a outstandingly awkward, to borrow her phrase, thing for the U.S. government to attempt to claim in court. But I guess we'll see. Jeez, I wonder, does that apply to Ramzi Youssef, the first World Trade Center bomber? Does that apply to the guys that bombed the Khobar Towers? Does that apply to the USS Cole attack in Yemen or September 11th? Oh, no, everybody knows history began in the 21st century. History began on September 11th, 2001. And they did it because somebody promised them virgins. And the guy who promised them virgins... well, someone had promised him virgins, too, and so that was his thing. And then there was promises of, after you're dead, then you get to have sex with virgins. And so that's why people do all these things. Doesn't that make the most sense to you? Isn't that what you believe, they believe? Yeah, I didn't think so either. That's stupid. Of course, it's the foreign policy. Kind of an important point to make from time to time. All right, and then let's see here. Yemen news. I need to get somebody good on about this. And this is about Al-Qaeda thriving on backlash to the takeover of the capital by the Houthi rebels, who, of course, you know, were built up as, you know, part of the backlash from the American-funded war against them by the previous government there. That was where all that, Gay Hill's done a great job writing about this. That's where all the anti-terrorist money went in Yemen, to fight Saleh's enemies. And now he's gone, and the remnants of his government have been driven out of power by a formerly marginal group, the Shiite Houthis of the North. And yet, as it says here in AP, the expansion of the Houthis to, you know, not a rebellion, but the rulers of the capital city has been a, quote, godsend for Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula as that civil war just heats up worse and worse. So, I need to make friends with that Gregory Johnson. I need to, should have read his book, but I need to at least read up a bunch of articles and interview him. He's really good on this stuff. Ah, and there's more. Oh, the police news I'm not going to be able to cover today. Go look at my Twitter feed. Go look at thefreethoughtproject.com. Right back at, with Boyd Cathy in a sec, y'all. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. If this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
The Klitschko piece is obviously the complicated electron here. Especially the announcement of him as deputy prime minister, and you've seen some of my notes on the troubles in the marriage right now, so we're trying to get a read really fast on where he is on this stuff. But I think your argument to him, which you'll need to make, I think that's the next phone call we want to set up, is exactly the one you made to Yachts. And I'm glad you sort of put him on the spot on where he fits in this scenario. And I'm very glad he said what he said in response.
I think Yachts is the guy who's got the economic experience, the governing.
All right. Well, that's Newland and Jeffrey Pyatt plotting a coup. I guess I'll go ahead and let it play. I'm sorry, I got the wrong phone number for this guest. Oops.
Experience. He's the guy, you know, what he needs is Cleach and Tawny Book on the outside. He needs to be talking to them four times a week, you know. I just think Cleach going in, he's going to be at that level working for Yatsenyuk. It's just not going to work.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. Okay, good. Well, do you want us to try to set up a call with him as the next step?
I can't remember if I told you this or if I only told Washington this, that when I talked to Jeff Feltman this morning, he had a new name for the UN guy, Robert Seri. Did I write
yeah.
you that this morning?
Yeah,
okay.
I saw that.
He's now gotten both Seri and Ban Ki-moon to agree that Seri could come in Monday or Tuesday.
Okay.
So that would be great, I think, to help glue this thing and have the UN help glue it and, you know, the EU.
No, exactly. And I think we've got to do something to make it stick together, because you can be pretty sure that if it does start to gain altitude, the Russians will be working behind the scenes to try to torpedo it.
So on that piece, Jeff, when I wrote the note, Sullivan's come back to me VFR saying you need Biden, and I said probably tomorrow for an attaboy and to get the deets to stick. So
okay.
Biden's willing.
All right, so there you have it. Intercepted presumably by the Russians and leaked. Victoria Nuland, a.k.a. Robert Kagan's wife, the American representative to the European Union, basically the ambassador to the EU, plotting with the American ambassador to Ukraine on the coup d'etat. And in fact, I have a link here somewhere, don't I? Oh, I did have it. Where'd it go? Well, anyway, the head of Stratfor was quoted recently in Kommersat, if that's how you say it, Kommersat or whatever. I don't have it in front of me. Saying this is the most obvious coup d'etat in world history was his phrase about it. And it's something that kind of has been, a mystery in a way, or something that's been sort of a object of obsession by those who know better than the official narrative, that the official narrative can be so wrong about what's happened to America's relationship with Russia over the last year, how it all started, what happened. How could it be that virtually the entire American media is willing to ignore the plain, obvious, established facts of the coup in Kiev that led to the current crisis? So, it's really something else. And now, okay, so I got the right number here. So let me see if I can find that. That clip. Well, I'm going to find that clip for you. Of Gideon Rose on the Colbert Show. God, if I can find it in this mess of files I have here. This is going to be problematic. So it's Gideon Rose. He is the editor of Foreign Affairs, which is the journal of the Council on Foreign Relations. And he went on the Colbert Report to talk about how America was running away with Ukraine. We're stealing it out from under the Russians' noses while they're distracted from the Olympics, he bragged, et cetera, et cetera. And this February the 24th of last year, and so it was 2 days after the coup. The coup actually took place on the night of February the 21st, 22nd. And here is Gideon Rose, the editor of Foreign Affairs, on the Colbert Report, explaining, hardy har har har, how we got
it. It's basically Robin to Russia's Batman. And the challenge here The challenge here is to try to attract it to the West, to get it to flip sides.
Is America taking sides in this in any way? If these people, the rebels are winning right now, right?
Yes, just
so
recently.
Why isn't Obama spiking the ball in the end zone and calling Putin and saying, hey, you might have won the medal count, but we won the country count, biatch.
It's actually a very good question, and the answer is that we don't want Russia to intervene and kick over the table like a game of Risk and take Ukraine back. And so
would they do that? Could he send in troops?
Yes, he could. So we are choosing...
Now, does Ukraine have any troops of their own? Would they fight back?
Yes, but we don't want this to escalate, and we don't want Russia to crack down. So we want to basically distract Russia. Oh, look, you have the highest medal count. Oh, you did really well. And you know, focus on the Olympics.
Here's a shiny object. We'll just take an entire country away from you.
Basically.
Now, there's a power vacuum right now.
There's a power vacuum. The opposition is all together, which everybody, it's easy to agree on getting rid of the bad old regime and much harder to create a stable country in which everybody compromises and moves forward. The reason we don't want Putin to get involved in this. And so we are basically, we want to try and involve him in this decision so that he allows Ukraine to go. We actually want to not, we want to say we want a non-exclusive relationship with Ukraine. You can have a relationship with it too.
You're the only one making this into a girlfriend-boyfriend relationship.
Ukraine is basically choosing its future between two completely different courses of action, and we're trying to blur that choice so the old boyfriend doesn't get too upset when it makes the right choice
really
towards
true.
Us.
They were the ones who gave the all or nothing ultimatum. You can either have a deal with Russia or with the EU, so that part of it is a lie. But anyway, a very important clip for you guys to hear, and you can find it online. It's quite easy. The guy's name is Gideon Rose, and even if you forget the name because it's kind of an obscure name, he's the editor of Foreign Affairs, so you could go look that up, and then all you got to do is search his name with Colbert, and you'll see. And there he is. You can hear it, and you can see it with your own eyes. There he is bragging about how the Americans were behind the coup and running away with Ukraine. All that as a great setup to introduce our first guest on the show today. This will be a short segment. It's Boyd D. Cathy, and he actually was formerly an assistant to the conservative author and philosopher Russell Kirk, which is quite interesting. He was the registrar of the North Carolina Division of Archives and History, has published in French, Spanish, and English on history as well as music and opera. He's active in the Sons of Confederate Veterans and various historical, archival, and genealogical organizations. Very interesting bio there. Here he is at UNZ.com. That's UNZ, UNZ.com, where Phil Giraldi and Eric Margolis and all them, right? And it's called Examining the Hatred of Vladimir Putin and Russia, a Conservative Analysis. Welcome to the show, Boyd. How are you doing?
Thank you. Thank you for having me on this program today.
Very happy to have you here, and I'm very sorry that this will be a real short segment before we have to go out to this first break. But I thought at least we can introduce the form of the essay here. You summarize five major allegations Vladimir Putin specifically. The article isn't all about Russia and all about anything Russia ever did. The article's about Putin himself and the caricature that has been made of him in the American media. And boy, do you poke some holes in it. But we just don't have time to start where I'd planned to start this interview, which was his role in the attempted coup d'etat, putting down the attempted coup d'etat in the summer of 1991. On the eve of the dissolution of the Soviet Union. But the music's going to start playing here in just a moment. And we got to go out to this break. When we get back, that's where we're going to pick up this subject with Boyd D. Cathy. I should have just called you during the break. I'm sorry. We'll pick up this subject on the other side of this break with Boyd D. Cathy. It's at UNZ.com, Examining the Hatred of Vladimir Putin and Russia. And you'll have plenty of time on the other side.
Hey, Al Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all, QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1-ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send him a message at commoditydiscs.com or check him out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks.
All right, y'all. Welcome back. Sorry about the awkwardness of this segment, but I just had a bad phone number. These things happen. Live radio. It's Boyd D. Cathy, a very interesting article here at the UNS Review, UNS.com, examining the hatred of Vladimir Putin and Russia. So just, Boyd, to try to get right to the point, this guy Putin, he looks scary. I can tell by looking at him that he's smart, and that scares me. And the Empire says that I should be very afraid of him. TV agrees. And so as far as I know, he's trying to recreate the Soviet Union because he is an unreconstructed KGB communist thug. And what else could he possibly want out of life other than to become Joe Stalin and reconquer Eastern Europe and recreate the Soviet Empire?
One of the very interesting points that I came across when I began to do research, and I began to study Russia in particular with the incursion in Georgia in 2008, began to collect information, most of which has never been aired on any of the American networks and in most American journals dealing with the topic. But Professor Ivan Lynch did a very fine study, what I would call middle of the road. He's very critical, but he's also very fair on Putin, called Vladimir Putin and Russian Statecraft. And I ran across the information in particular about the counter coup, the attempted counter coup that the KGB attempted to stage against the liberalization of Russia in August of 1991. By that time,
so this was Putin, now just for people who are too young or fuzzy memories, this is after the fall of the wall and mostly the liberation
of
Eastern Europe.
Wall,
but it was still the USSR, and the red flag still flew
still
above
is.
The Kremlin
it
until Christmas.
Is. Yeah, they haven't completely broken up yet. Putin had put his faith with the reformers by that time. In other words, he saw the handwriting on the wall, and he became vice mayor of Leningrad under Anatoly Sobchak. Anatoly Sobchak was a very pro-Western Democrat leader reformist in the Soviet Union at the time. So Putin had pledged to support Sobchak. Seeing the potential for a counter coup, he helped organize the Leningrad militia, protective militia, to protect the new democracy in Russia at that time. In August of 91, the KGB attempted, and by the way, Putin had resigned from the KGB by then, but in August of 91, they attempted a counter coup. It was partially successful in Moscow. If it had succeeded in Leningrad, the Soviet Union would have been restored to its full tyranny. Putin was responsible for guarding Sobchak. Sobchak was flying in by plane. He landed. Putin organized the militia. They went and met him at the plane and kept the KGB counter coup guys, the coup guys, from taking over Leningrad. The question that I raise after verifying this information, it is in Lynch's book, by the way, he details it in great detail, is if Putin had been a KGB plant, why not at this very appropriate moment, why did he go with the Democrats? Why did he go with somebody who favored the complete dissolution of the Soviet system? Doesn't add up.
And you mentioned in the article, too, that there have been studies done of his close associates and all the people around him, and people have gone through to really pick through and see whether it's the case that these guys that surround him now are all just a bunch of KGB oligarchs. Even if he got rid of some oligarchs, he just replaced them with his buddies, they say.
Yeah, the very interesting point is if we reflect back to the early 90s when Boris Yeltsin was president, Yeltsin was called, I suppose you could use the term affectionately, he was called America's poodle, in that he did the bidding of the United States, and he allowed basically, under the name of capitalism, the plundering of Russian industry, Gazprom, et cetera, through these big oligarchs who basically controlled huge percentage of Russian industry and commerce. When Putin was elected He was, by the way, Yeltsin's choice. He came in, he decided this was not the way to run a government or a country. Economically, Russia was a basket case, and he basically disassembled the authority of these big industrialists and decentralized industry at that particular point, which allowed thousands of Russians to become property owners and to invest, which affected the Russian economy. Of course, the Russian economy still is dependent upon gas in, to a large degree, and natural industry, natural oil, but natural gas. But by doing that, he antagonized a lot of the more international financiers on Wall Street and in Brussels and other places. The accusation then is that he is a thug, partly is based on also on some of the political opponents that he made during this period of time. He's been in office now two terms. A lot of his opponents, much more liberal opponents, don't like the idea that he's been successful and that he's very popular. And they have accused him. I gave one point, I think, in the article where he was charged with padding his own nest. He sued in court and won in a French court. Not only that, Lynch points out that there was a famous fire. His home in St. Petersburg caught fire. I think it was in 1996. Everything was destroyed, his dacha. He had $5,000 in savings. That was his total amount. Now, if he had been the kind of thuggish oligarch that many people charge and had been mayor of St. Petersburg and Yeltsin's right-hand man, don't you think he would have made a lot more money and stashed it away? And just $5,000? I mean, the guy is rather austere. I don't think money means that much for him. I think the Russian nation, the Russian equality with the United States, parity, partnership, these were his goals. Mm-hmm. I mean, after all, Russia is the largest nation in the world.
Well, and as you point out in the article, and it's so important that after September 11th, he said, hey, anything you need. He was the first person to call George Bush. Anything you need, pal.
He was the first person to offer the full. I mean, Russia had just finished fighting a vicious terrorist war in Chechnya, and Russian expertise files were there on many of these terrorists from the Caucasus region and other areas. And Putin offered directly to George Bush, hey, we've got all this material. We will be pleased to assist you in this. And they were rebuffed. They were basically told, stick your head in the ground. I mean, go away.
Yeah, Eric Margolis says that he had to really face down right-wing and military opposition inside Russia to do it, too. It was not just, you know, Putin's will is law.
I mean,
it was a big deal.
At this point, Putin was hoping. I mean, his whole goal had always been, look, we're still a major power. We would like some parity with the United States. We don't want to be in control. We want to have parity and partnership with the United States. That's what we're looking for. And at every turn, I mean, the case of NATO, I mean, the Budapest Agreement, which basically dissolved the old Soviet Union and allowed these 14, 15 republics to go their own way, basically said, look, we're going to allow all of this part of Soviet Russia, of Soviet Union, to leave. Some of these areas like Belarus and parts of Ukraine had never been independent. It had always been part of Russia. But they allowed them to go. But the quid pro quo here was NATO was not to expand. And so what do? We start expanding. I mean, there was the Georgian situation where Saakashvili basically attacks the Russian troops, the peacekeepers in South Ossetia. Obviously, the Free Baltic states, that's a different case because they had been independent. But we have pushed this issue forward. The Victoria Nuland famous phone call after we had already made a solemn agreement that Yanukovych in Ukraine would stay in power to this past December, we go back on the agreement. Nuland says, and the message was copied by the Estonians, Yats is the man. So we organize a coup against what we pledged we weren't going to do. And It's amazing. We had $5 billion supporting NGOs in the Ukraine to overturn the legally accepted government of Yanukovych. In other words, when it doesn't suit us, we overthrow the government.
Yeah.
And in Kosovo, for example, we set up a way, we support secession movement. I mean, it's based on our feeling of international global interest. It's basically the neocons at work to establish this global order.
Right.
And,
well, you know, I wanted to ask you, too, you focus a lot on the culture war, and it does seem important, and especially for a culture warrior, but it seems to me like the American government is just as happy to be allies or enemies with any communist or fascist or any other kind of totalitarian government in the world at any given time. They never really cared that the Soviet Union was communist any more than they care that Putin is a right-winger now. What they care about is Russian independence, right? It's the same thing they hate about Iran. It's the same thing they hate about Cuba, is that these people would dare to tell America no. And that's why they hate him so much, is they can't figure out a way to get him to come to heel other than, as Carl Gershman from the NED put it in the Washington Post, maybe they'll just have to do one of these color-coded coup d'etats in Russia and just get rid of him. Because they just can't stand for Russia to stand apart.
You're quite right. You hit upon it. And the idea that there is a nation that stands apart economically, and again, not as much politically, but economically, on an international level. And of course, you cannot ignore Russia. I mean, if we're talking about Albania or Montenegro, it might be a little bit different. It might be a less of a concern if we're talking about a smaller country like that. But in this, we're talking about the largest, geographically speaking, country in the world with 10,000 nuclear warheads. And a country that exerts through the BRICS Association of Nations a very powerful economic and to some degree social influence on large parts of the world. And when Yeltsin was playing the game of subservience to American interest, you know, that was okay. I mean, I remember hearing Charles Krauthammer and others praise Yeltsin because of this particular position that he took. When Putin reasserted meekly at first, very meekly at first, Russian nationalism, that Russia needed to refind itself, which in large degree it has done through the rebirth of the Russian Orthodox Church, 26,000 new Orthodox churches have opened in Russia since 1991. Even, I think, Franklin Graham commented that this was indeed a revival of tremendous proportions in religion. I mean, we cannot, our leadership, I should say, the leadership here in the United States cannot abide a country that asserts its own nationality and its independence. If it is not subservient to the elements that exist on Wall Street, then something has to be done. We have to, Alan Bloom, I remember in his book, Closing of the American Mind, say we're going to impose our views on the rest of the world, whether they like it or not. And this is the antithesis of traditional conservatism. That's what I was trying to suggest in the article, that sure, if you go back and read traditional conservatives like Russell Kirk and Robert Nisbet, you know, conservatives favor the proliferation of traditions, plural, in different countries. We applaud different traditions and different histories. We don't want to impose a uniformity on the rest of the world. This is the antithesis. That particular view is the antithesis of what the neoconservatives now attempt to do in the United States around the rest of the world.
Yep.
And that's why Russia has become a pariah and an enemy. And all of these particular charges, most of which are false and groundless, are being made.
Right. Well, you know, you hit it on the head there when you mentioned the H-bombs. They've got thousands of them. We've got thousands of them. Which means that if you accept the premise that human life is important at all, then this is the single most important thing in the world. The most significant issue on the planet is the relationship between America's government and Russia's government. And to think that 25 years after the end of the Cold War, that we're headed right back into it, where Henry Kissinger is saying, oh, this would be such a tragedy if we really get back into a real Cold War with Russia here.
You've got Henry Kissinger and the late George Kennan both condemning American posture on this issue, because we have gone back on the major agreements we've made. We have pushed NATO to the very borders I give the example when I talk about this. Suppose the United States had lost the Cold War, and suppose Texas, California, and Alaska and Hawaii had all basically been released from the United States. And Soviet Union then had gotten into Texas and established, or a coup that established, say, Mexican authority over Texas. Suppose this happened. And suppose the Anglos living up in East Texas, well, the first thing they did is suppress the speaking of English in that area. Can you imagine the United States being, can you imagine the United States' view of this? What kind of response the rest of the United States would have had in this particular situation? I mean, you've got a similar situation in Ukraine where Crimea, prior to 1954, when Khrushchev in a drunken fit gave it to Ukraine, had never been a part of Ukraine. The oblasts of Luhansk and Donetsk, again, 1920s, early 1920s, were given to Ukraine. They had never been a part of Ukraine. They were Russian-speaking areas. I mean, we've got a situation, a terrible situation here, and we've aggravated it through our own policy decisions, our support of NGOs and revolution, the color revolutions, et cetera. And this is, you know, as George Kennan pointed out, this is an absolutely insane foreign policy. We should be negotiating in good faith, treating the Russians as partners. The idea of neutrality for states like Ukraine and Belarus and some of the Caucasian and Asian states is what was intended, and that's what we should be arguing for. People as diverse as Professor Stephen Cohen, who's not a right-winger certainly, at New York University, and John Mearsheim at the University of Chicago, who wrote recently in Foreign Affairs, suggest the same thing. We are not doing that. We are becoming hostile. We are initiating a new, very warm Cold War, and that's not something we should be doing.
Yeah. Well, the good news is there that it's up to us to knock it off. We don't have to rely on the other side. It's basically safe to assume that they'll play it cool if we can start getting our government to back off a little bit, which
Absolutely.
That's the hard part. But anyway, I'm sorry we're so way out of time and overtime here, and I have to let you go. Sorry for the difficulty in getting the interview together here today, but maybe we'll talk again soon.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate
for having
Boyd.
Me.
That's Boyd Cathy, everybody. The article is at UNZ.com, UNZ.com, examining the hatred of Vladimir Putin and Russia, a conservative analysis. A very important article for your brother-in-law. We'll be right back. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott. Well, I kept him through the break. I should have just kept interviewing him through that first break, too, but I'm trying to be fair to you guys and do as much of the show live as I can so that you live listeners can hear it all. I know it sounds terrible going out to break in the middle of a sentence, in the middle of a word, but what are you going to do? You know, I don't know. What am I going to do? I don't know. All right. Well, we got Jason Ditz on the line. Thank goodness for that. He's at news.antiwar.com, and thank goodness for that, too. On top of just about every news story of importance in the world all day, every day, writing it up for you, linking to the original and pointing out the important part of what they say that ain't true, etc. Really good stuff, as always, there. Welcome back to the show, Jason. How are you doing?
I'm doing good, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing real good. Appreciate you joining us. So, first of all, I wanted to say we're a day late and a dollar short on this. Just because of scheduling difficulties last week. But no, I saw the BS and the nonsense and the things that seemed to me like they just couldn't possibly be right on the TV news this morning. That somehow still it's North Korea hacked Sony and terrorists threatened every movie theater in America in a act of some sort of war, said John McCain, or an act of, I forgot what Obama called it, some other jargon. Anyway, so good. The news story is still fresh. There's new sanctions even that Obama continues to sign. So tell me the truth. What all do we know about who hacked Sony and what all they have to do with North Korea and or threatening to kill movie theater patrons, et cetera, et cetera. Please, sir.
Well, the evidence, as it's been shown to us by investigators who've been looking into this, is strongly pointing towards this GOP group being a group of at least six people, but including at least one former Sony Pictures employee who was disgruntled and had a lot of information about the inner workings of their network, which is really what people were saying when the hack first happened. The North Korea theory only popped up later because the hack happened to coincide with the release of the Interview movie. And so it looks like the first suspicion was actually the right one. There's no indication these people were working with North Korea, except that the FBI mentioned the possibility, and after the FBI mentioned that possibility, these people said, oh, yeah, we're North Koreans, which seems designed just to throw them off of actually catching the people who did it.
Yeah. Well, it's funny, you know, I want to get on the email list that all these TV news people are on that tell them all what to say when they all say the same thing. So there's real doubt as to whether the evidence cited by the FBI amounts to evidence at all that this hack originated in North Korea, an IP address. That doesn't mean anything, you know, this kind of thing. Well, I guess the North Koreans must have hired whoever it was that did it. Where, okay, I mean, they're basically all just saying that, but, well, I don't know. Am I missing anything? Because they didn't seem to cite any reason to believe that. It seemed like, oh, well, the answer is not one. Maybe it's two, not maybe it's one and a half, you know?
Right. And the FBI has kind of just gone along with this theory that basically they invented themselves, that it could be North Korea. And once the people said, oh, yeah, we're North Korea, that was enough for them. They haven't presented any serious evidence that it was North Korea. These IP address claims aren't conclusive proof of much of anything. It just seems like they took a wild guess and they've decided to stick with it because it was politically convenient.
Yeah. I mean, I don't even know why they're embarrassed to just backtrack 180 degrees. Why only 90? It's not like they have any shame anyway. You know, Glenn Greenwald did that great write-up where he just showed just, you know, and naming and shaming all of these media stars, you know, pushing this stuff with no real reason to believe it. And all the while you have real experts saying otherwise, right? Like it took a full, I don't know, week or week and a half of articles at Wired and this and that other computer tech magazine or website, right? People who it's mainstream media as far as it's perfectly acceptable. It's just marginal because it's kind of niche technology groupings or whatever, but it's not politically marginal in any way. Wired.com, right? But it took, you know, many days, and then finally CNN ran a story that said, okay, well, there's some discrepancies here. And then it was okay for everybody else to acknowledge that, all right, well, maybe. But that was what was most interesting to me, was how the story was not holding up in, you know, according to people like Bruce Schneier, you know, other very kind of prominent technologists that mainstream media would listen to in any other case, right? But in this case, they're contradicting the government, so they just, and they don't say, well, Bruce Schneier must not know what he's talking about. They just ignore him. They just don't even have him on for a week until somebody gives the okay to finally break narrative and go ahead and start incorporating new facts into the story. Partially.
Right. And it's because the FBI narrative is the more interesting story. I mean, having this be just another in a long line of corporate hacks that involve a disgruntled former employee, that's kind of boring.
Yeah.
I mean, we've mm-hmm. done that before. Having it the launch of a cyber war with North Korea, I mean, that's big news.
Right. Well, and it seems like they're getting a lot of mileage out of it, too. I mean, the news is getting their mileage out of it, selling dish soap and whatever. But and running ads for the Wounded Warrior Project for all the people that they've got maimed with their lies the last time around. It looks like Congress and the executive branch have their plans, too, to pass new cybersecurity measures and maybe help push through the regulating of the Internet as a public utility on a national level and all this kind of stuff, yeah?
Right, and this has been pushed for quite a while by the Obama administration. They've had designs on this for years. Every time they get a proposal into Congress, it sparks a major public backlash, and they kind of have to back down. This time, it's being presented not so much as protection against just general hackers, but as a national security issue because of North Korea. And there's a lot of sense among Congress that they have to just move quick on this and not take a lot of time to debate the consequences for privacy, the consequences for freedom in general on the Internet, and just give the administration all the new powers they want.
Yeah, big trouble there. And so you have a write-up here from yesterday, Sony Hack, a Prime Excuse for New U.S. Cybersecurity Laws. Is it just, I can't keep track of SOPA and CISPA and all these. Is it one or the other of those exactly reincarnate? Can you describe what you expect the new bills to really do?
Well, it's they haven't actually been presented yet. The new Congress, when it begins meeting this month, is expected to bring forward some plans, and they're probably going to look extremely similar to CISPA and SOPA and all of these previous acts. Even though most of the information sharing requirements and other, you know, giving the administration the power to shut down websites for national security reasons, most of this stuff has nothing to do with what happened at Sony and wouldn't even conceivably stop a hack like that.
Right. And since we're now, a year and a half out from the Snowden revelations, it makes you wonder why they need any of this stuff. When, of course, they can have all our data whenever they want it, however they want it. They got a workaround for every barrier, every time. So, anyway, hold it right there, Jason. When we get back, I'm going to ask you about Israel-Palestine and some other things listed there at news.antiwar.com. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, guys, welcome back. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org for the archives. I'm behind a few days there, but don't worry, I'll catch up. There's 3,500 of them going back to 2003, so unless you already heard them all, you can, fill in the time until the updates come. Follow me on Twitter if you want to be insulted, at Scott Horton Show. Okay, I'm talking with the great Jason Ditz. He is the news editor at antiwar.com. news.antiwar.com, and you have quite a few here about Israel-Palestine politics going on. And maybe at the end I'll try to ask you about the upcoming elections and stuff. I guess first I want to talk about I don't know what's more important, really. I want to talk about the Palestinians' move at the United Nations, seeking to join the World Court and the International Criminal Court, and Netanyahu's reaction and all that. If you can fill us in, please, sir.
Well, sure. After the vote at the UN Security Council on the Palestine resolution failed, it was the vote was 8-2 in favor. It needed at least 9 to pass, but there were 5 abstentions. And the U.S. vetoed it on top of that, even though it wasn't going to pass anyway.
And what exactly was that resolution again?
The resolution said basically that Israel has until the end of 2017 to withdraw to the 1967 borders.
Okay, so it didn't necessarily, it wasn't exactly about the establishment of a state, but obviously it was along the lines of trying to create the preconditions for one on the facts on the ground there, correct?
Right.
Okay.
Right. It was about ending the occupation, which
right.
is the one thing really holding the PA back from being more than just a provisional state. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then I'm sorry to interrupt there. And then after that resolution failed in the UN Security Council, then what?
After that failed, Palestinian President Abbas signed the documents that would accede the Palestinians into the international criminal courts, which the U.S. and Israel are both loudly opposing now and presenting as a huge, huge act of aggression, because if Palestinian territory is under the jurisdiction of the ICC, then Israeli war crimes in these assorted wars on Palestinian territory that they get into every couple of years would actually be an international court matter.
Mm-hmm. And so, boy, I don't know. I mean, I'm not an advertising executive. I don't know if there's any kind of better spin that they really could put on this. But it seems like they're really failing when all they have to say is, hey, you stay away from that court that charges people with war crimes when they commit them sometimes, because we do not want to be convicted of the war crimes that we've committed. I mean, that's basically what they're saying here, right?
Right. And
it's not like they're trying to say, oh, yeah, right, as though we committed any war crimes. They're just saying outright, hey, we don't want to be held accountable.
Right, and that's been the case for the U.S. and Israel both in the past, because they both signed the accession papers into the ICC, but then they later refused to ratify them and informed them that they have no intention of ratifying them, specifically because they don't want to have world court jurisdiction for the war crimes they commit.
Now, I'm not really a big fan of these things myself. I would prefer the American people hold their politicians accountable, and the Israeli people would hold their politicians accountable, but so much for that. So somebody's got to prosecute them, right?
Right. And Netanyahu has argued that he doesn't think the ICC is going to accept the Palestinians because they're not a state. The ICC is for states. I think that argument, though, is a little weak, because everybody recognizes the Palestinian Authority as a provisional government. Even Israel treats the Palestinian Authority as a provisional government. I mean, their first hostile action after trying to get ICC membership was to revoke tax money from the Palestinians. I mean, obviously this is state-to-state diplomacy that we're talking about, even if the Palestinians' territory that constitutes their state is all under military occupation. So I think there's really no good reason the ICC is going to have to refuse them. The U.S. doesn't have veto power over the court because they haven't ever ratified the ICC charter to begin with, so they're not really a member in good standing of the world court to begin with. So I don't see where the U.S. and Israeli objections are going to go all that far.
Although they can really severely damage, well, definitely the Palestinian Authority's authority, as well as the quality of life of the people of Palestine by withholding all that tax money, because, as we're discussing, the territory is occupied. The Israelis collect all the border checkpoint money and all the trade tariff money and all that stuff. And the Palestinian Authority is completely dependent on the Israelis, or at least in large measure dependent on the Israelis, to give them the money, right? This is how they seemingly deliberately or very stupidly got Hamas half elected back in 2006, was by withholding all the money from Arafat and his guys.
Right, and Israel does this so often. I mean, literally, the Palestinian tax revenue gets withheld by Israel several times a year. Whenever Netanyahu's in a bad mood, he's just, you know, we'll show them. We're going to withhold their tax money. Israeli President Reuven Rivlin is really criticizing that today, though. He's pointing out that weakening the Palestinian Authority is just going to harm Israel's interests in the occupation, because the Palestinian Authority, I mean, whatever else it is, and whether it is diplomatically at odds with Israel sometimes, is really helping the Israeli military administer this occupation in a lot of its, in a lot of the West Bank.
Right, and now, so that's the other article here, is Israel diverting military budget to settlement expansion. Now, of course, dollars are fungible, so Americans are subsidizing their socialist health care and education system and every bit of their fascist occupation in the occupied territories and the rest of it. But it is interesting when, you know, it's, they're deliberately taking the money out of the military budget and giving it straight to the colonists on the occupied West Bank.
Oh, right, and Beit El is such a disaster of a settlement. It's right on the outskirts of two major Palestinian cities, including Ramallah, which is their de facto capital right now. It's built almost entirely on privately owned Palestinian land, which is always a problem to begin with, but it's especially a problem here because it's also not contiguous. So,
oh, right. Yeah, this is the one that separates East Jerusalem from the rest of the West Bank, right?
Right.
Yeah, I'm sorry. We're all out of time. Thank you so much for your time, Jason. Great to talk to you.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
That's the great Jason Ditz. News.antiwar.com. Bookmark that. News.antiwar.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. And like I promised last Friday, I got Bell True on the line. And, oh no, I'm sorry, I am unprepared. I am paging down, hoping there's a good bio at the bottom of this piece here so I can give her a good introduction. Nope, unfortunately not. But I will tell you that this great piece is at foreignpolicy.com. A ground invasion of the Capitol is imminent. In quotes, that's the title there, a quote from General Haftar, I believe. A ground invasion of the Capitol is imminent. Welcome back to the show, Bell. How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing real good. I appreciate you joining us, and I'm so sorry I'm not prepared here. Could you please introduce yourself, who all you write for?
Hi, I'm Bell True, and I am a reporter mostly for the Times of London, based in Egypt, but I cover the Middle East.
Okay, great. Sunday Times, London Times. There we go. Okay, so, yeah, and we've spoken about Libya and I think Egypt one time in the past if people want to check the archives there. So this is a great article about Libya, and it really stands out on its own, but also in comparison to the real lack of information coming out of there, at least in American media, about what has been going on there. And you really break it down very well here. So I guess if we could start with a bit of the who's who here. I think I must be a bit confused, or maybe the confusion is reality's fault. But am I right that you write that the Islamists have more say in the West and the quote-unquote secularists, at least, have more say in the East, even though back in the Civil War in 2011 it was more the Islamist rebels backed by NATO moving from the east to the west to sack the you know, pseudo, whatever you call them, secularist, militarist power of Gaddafi out of Tripoli. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very, obviously, Libya is a bit of a mess, and as happens with civil war, but if you want to put it in quite simple terms, you've got a divide now between two sides of the country, east and west. In the west, we've got this coalition called Libya Dawn of militias, some Islamist-leaning politicians, and also jihadi groups, which they admitted to me. And they've got control of Tripoli and large swathes of territory in the west. In the east, where you've got the official internationally recognized government, which, as you said, is more secular, they've are in exile in the east at the moment. They've got their own recently rebranded Libyan National Army, and they are battling different groups in the east, but their sort of stronghold is in the far eastern towns near the Egyptian border.
Mm-hmm. And now, what about the Americans and the European Union and NATO, the spies, the special forces? Are they picking sides in this thing?
Well, they've definitely backed what is being regarded as the official government, which, as I said, is in exile in the east. And that's because that comes off the back of an election. There's an elected parliament. It was elected over the summer last year. And they were based in Tripoli until the sort of fighting grew so intense that they were forced to the east by these militias and Islamist leading politicians in the west. So in terms of America, NATO, the EU, Western politicians, they are backing what they call the government that's based in the east at the moment.
Mm-hmm. And as you say in the article, the Egyptians, the Saudis, and the United Arab Emirates are playing a role there, too. Can you describe to what degree they're backing them? I mean, is this a real effort to help them win in the short term somehow?
Well, over the course of last year, we had some mysterious airstrikes in Tripoli where quite advanced fighter jets just appeared out of nowhere and started bombing the positions of the kind of Islamist side in the capital. And no one has claimed responsibility for that. But U.S. government officials and intelligence said that it was Egypt and the UAE. Now, I know for a fact that Egypt, the UAE and Saudi have definitely supplied weapons, intelligence and funds to the Libyan, let's put it in quote unquote, government in the east. That's something that the Libyan government have told me has happened and the Egyptians have tentatively agreed to as well. In terms of these mysterious airstrikes, no one has claimed responsibility for them. But if it was Egypt and the UAE, that would mean that they're really putting in a lot of effort to help that side win.
All right, now to the title here, and I know writers don't always pick their titles, but the title is A Ground Invasion of the Capital is Imminent, and if I remember right, that is a quote from General Haftar, correct? The guy that lived in Virginia for 30 years?
Yeah, General Khalifa Haftar is an interesting character. He was a military commander under the former dictator, Muammar Gaddafi, until they fell out over the Chad War and he escaped, supposedly under the help of the CIA, to Virginia, where he lived for several years. He sort of built himself up as an opposition figure against Gaddafi and finally returned during the Civil War as a victorious returning opposition hero who led the frontline battles against Gaddafi. Since the Civil War, he's become a little bit of a difficult character. In February of last year, he suddenly declared that he'd overthrown the last parliament, which was met with some sort of sarcastic rebuffs by the government at the time. And he started to wage a self-proclaimed war against Islamist militias and jihadis that were taking over the second city of Benghazi, which is in the east. So he was a bit of an outlawed figure. He was rejected from the military, and the government at the time said he was basically acting on his own. But in the recent few months, with the internationally recognized government having no power of no sort of military power of their own, realizing they can't fight this battle against the militias, the Islamists and the jihadis with just words alone, they've accepted him back into the fold. And he's now the sort of military commander of, as I said, the rebranded Libyan National Army. And he told me that his troops were poised to enter the capital. That hasn't happened yet. And there's still fierce fighting now happening across the country, both in the west, in the center, in the east, in the south, everywhere. It's complete chaos. So he's still vowing that he's going to have his troops in central Tripoli to take it back from the Islamist militias who took over last August. But when that's going to happen, we'll have to see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was going to be my question, was, are you buying that at all? What does his strength look like? I was reminded when I was reading this of a recent article about, I think it was in Afghanistan, where, Kurdish fighters outside of Mosul talking about how, oh yeah, we're about to walk right into Mosul here just the day after tomorrow, and claiming thousands and thousands more fighters than they really have, that kind of thing. Because of course, the bigger the boast, the greater likelihood of more CIA money coming in to help them actually get bigger, that kind of thing, right?
Yeah, I mean, definitely this is somewhat, it has become somewhat of an evergreen statement now from General Hifter. The problem is that his actual troops are in the east who are fighting jihadi groups and militias allied with the Islamists in the west, in cities like Benghazi and also in some of the big eastern oil fields and ports in the kind of central strip of the country. He's got some groups which are backing him who are armed. I guess you could say that they were formerly militias, and now they've been, you know, absorbed into what's called the Libyan National Army, that's by Tripoli, and they're trying to enter the capital, but they're not very strong on the ground. And as I said, that there are these battles happening across the country. So he's sending over his fighter jets at the moment to bomb parts of Tripoli, nearby Misrata, and some of these central oil fields, which are contested at the moment. But I don't see him marching into Tripoli anytime soon, simply because there are so many front lines. You know, his troops, his fighter jets are spread, you know, across the country. And don't forget that these militias are really well armed. Gaddafi left huge stockpiles of weapons after he was ousted in 2011. Which people were basically allowed to pick up, anyone. I mean, Libya is awash with weapons. Even civilians have AK-47s at home. So these militias are charging around the place with anti-aircraft guns, SAM, you know, surface-to-air missiles, planes. You know, it's a serious force that he's fighting. So I can't see him sort of charging into Tripoli in the next week.
Right. And now, well, music's playing. So we'll have to take this break, but when we get back, I have a lot more questions for you. First one, I think, will be along the lines of just how many different militias and, you know, tribal, sectarian, Islamists, this, that, the other groups fighting here. Major battle lines are one thing. Minor ones are many more things. But we'll be right back with Bell True on the other side of this break. The great article at foreignpolicy.com is called "The Ground Invasion of the Capital is Imminent." You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott. I'm talking with Bell True. She writes for The Times in London. And this one is at foreignpolicy.com. A ground invasion of the capital is imminent. A great write-up on the current crisis in Libya. And so, you mentioned there, Bell, about how there are just so many different well-armed militias all over the place. Do you have any kind of ballpark estimate as to how many actual different groups we're talking about, and the different ranks and loyalties, and just how much of a grudge they each have? Are they fighting for their own little piece of territory? They each have grand plans for Tripoli someday, or what's the deal?
Well, basically, to give you a bit of a background, these are ex-rebels. Most of them are ex-rebels. So they fought against Gaddafi. They were armed by countries like America, the US, and of course through NATO. And after the fall of Gaddafi, they were basically, the government at the time didn't know what to do with them. They had huge amounts of weapons. They weren't going to go home. They certainly weren't going to put down their anti-aircraft guns. So at the time, the Libyan transitional government basically absorbed them into the interior ministries and the defense ministries. which means they put them on the government payroll. So that means there's about 1,500 different militias who are officially on the government books and are still being paid by the government because the budget is an old one that was set by law and can't be changed. So we have a ridiculous situation right now where the elected parliament and its cabinet are fighting over 1,500 militias who are being paid by the government to continue their work. That can't be changed until the next financial year, the next budget, which will be set at some point in the middle of this civil war. Huh. So those are just the militias that are officially registered by the government. There's a lot of other groups. They have conflicting allegiances. They want different parts of territories. They have their own brigade commanders. It's really haphazard. We're talking about basically normal people who picked up a lot of weapons during the Civil War and have been charging around with those weapons ever since. And on top of that, as you mentioned before the break, there's also the tribes as well. There are dozens of tribes who have their own allegiances, who are also very heavily armed and occupying different parts of the country, protecting their territory. So it's a total mess and a massive headache, with all sides receiving funds, being massively heavily armed, having access to airports, planes, you name it.
Mm-hmm. All right. So, well, yeah, and we've seen the battle for the Tripoli airport and all the refineries on fire, all this stuff. But now, so what about ISIS? We see lots of headlines about those declaring loyalty to the Islamic State running around fighting in Libya. But what's the truth of that on the ground, do you think?
Well, what we're seeing at the moment is quite a worrying bubbling of extremism coming through Libya. Imagine how huge Libya is. It's over 2,000 kilometers long. It has enormous borders with Egypt, with Tunisia, with all these different countries. And those borders are completely unguarded. They're open. There's no control. There's no state. There's no police. There's no military. There's no nothing. And meanwhile, you've got a lot of heavily armed people, many of them with quite strong Islamic, or I'd say we can't even really call this Islamic because the kind of extremist jihadist ideology doesn't reflect Islam at all, but extremist thoughts charging about the country. So what we've seen is a movement of groups, first of all, towards Al-Qaeda, with one of the biggest terrorist organizations that's been designated a terrorist organization by the UN called Ansar al-Sharia. And now, most recently, different splinter groups from that declaring allegiance to the Islamic State. That happened in just literally on Halloween, the last day of October. And these groups are quite serious about it. It's mostly centered around a city in the east called Derna, which has basically been occupied by these kind of jihadi groups for over a year now. It's becoming to look a bit like Libya's version of Raqqa in Syria. Hmm. It's controlled by these extremists. They've declared allegiance to ISIS. They're imposing Sharia law. They have their own Sharia law courthouse, their own Sharia law police force. They have beheaded activists who are writing against them. They have taken... they've killed a lot of different soldiers and other groups hostage, taken other groups hostage. So we are unfortunately seeing ISIS very much happening in Libya. And at the same time, we've also got reports that they're running training camps, which would make sense considering Libya has such open borders and it's bordering countries like Tunisia. It has airports. So you can easily fly to Turkey to enter Syria or Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Well, and going back a couple of years, we saw how the war immediately spread into Mali, where the jihadists hijacked the Tuareg rebellion there. The Tuareg rebellion that had kind of been doubled in power because of Gaddafi's weapons and all that mess. But now, so when we have, I mean, if they're really turning Derna into Raqqa over there and that kind of situation, does that mean that it's just a matter of time before Egypt invades? Or are they just going to let that fester that way? I mean, after all, like you said, the government is paying their enemies because they have to, like some episode of Yes Minister or whatever, so... why not let them stay? I don't know.
I mean, Egypt is definitely looking across its borders quite with a lot of concern. There was a cross-border attack last year which killed a lot of Egyptian soldiers, as supposedly jihadis managed to cross over into Egypt and attack Egyptian soldiers. We know that there has been sort of pledges of allegiance between Egypt's domestic terrorist groups and Libya's. And of course, this new declaration of ISIS means we've got this kind of international brand extremist group, you know, in all these countries. So, I mean, I don't, but at the same time, I don't think Egypt wants to get involved in an international conflict. It's already got its hands full dealing with domestic terrorism problems and also trying to silence dissent. There's been obviously its own uprising back in 2011 and in 2013, the military takeover, and since then quite a brutal crackdown. So the government's got its hands full here and doesn't really want to engage in any kind of direct combat with heavily armed Libyan jihadis. But certainly it's a problem that can't be left alone, and it's certainly as an observer, you know, and having travelled around Libya extensively recently, it's something that I think is extremely worrying, particularly given the, you know, openness of Libya's borders and the fact that these jihadi groups have access to airports and heavy weaponry.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I think it's just a matter of time. It's sort of irresistible temptation of probably it may have to wait for Hillary or Jeb to do it to get the Americans involved. But that's sure to only make matters worse regardless. But I could see them trying, because what else are you going to do? Let it become a declared affiliate of the Islamic State and loyal to Caliph Ibrahim and all this? I mean, that's a PR catastrophe too far for Washington, D.C. there, I think, right?
I mean, absolutely. I think the Americans are keeping a much closer eye on Libya than they profess to be doing in the media. If you speak to people who are living in Benghazi, which is, as I said, the second city in the east that's been a sort of massive battleground between General Haftar's forces and the sort of militias and jihadi groups against him, there are American drones flying above Benghazi almost every single day. They're keeping a really close eye on what's going on, particularly after the 2012 attack on the American consulate, which killed U.S. Ambassador Chris Stevens. And of course, you know, we're seeing the trial of those Libyans who are accused of being involved in that attack, that brutal attack at the moment. So the Americans are certainly watching this with a lot of interest. Whether they're going to act is yet to be seen. I mean, they do hold a lot of responsibility, as does the UK and other NATO countries, for intervening in the civil war and, you know, arming the rebels, essentially leaving the fledgling government to deal with the mess afterwards. And that's why you're seeing such a disastrous collapse into civil war at the moment. Whether they'll risk coming back into Libya and attempting to intervene as they are in Syria and Iraq is yet to be seen. I think they have lost, as you said, a massive PR battle with all their international wars they've been fighting recently.
Yeah. All right. Now, so here's a subject that was a real big deal back in 2011 and 2012, and then just disappeared from pretty much all reporting that I know of, and that is the plight of sub-Saharan black Africans in Libya after the initial mass racial pogroms that took place at the hands of the rebels that America and NATO fought for, I guess some of these same groups that we're talking about right now. Whatever happened to them? Are they okay? Or did they flee the country? Were they killed? How many people are we talking about? Does anyone even know?
I mean, definitely Libya is quite... I mean, and I'll get into trouble with Libyans, I know, but it's a fairly racist country in the sense that there is a big difference between those who classify as Libyans and anyone who's regarded as a sub-Saharan African. At the moment, we're still seeing, there's been a lot of attacks on Libyan tribes who, like the Tuaregans, whose tribes actually are also in Libya and also other African countries. And they're labeled as kind of foreigners, and they are still living in displacement camps now. 3 years after the toppling of Gaddafi, they were forced out of their camps and charged with supporting Gaddafi, out of their homes and charged with supporting Gaddafi, and have been living in refugee camps ever since. And their situation is very, very dire. In addition to that, you've obviously got sub-Saharan African workers who have a sort of forced to come to Libya to get work and try and make that perilous journey through to Italy via the Lampedusa crossing. They are still very much around in Tripoli and the other cities trying to make a living, and of course dying in their thousands as they make that dangerous crossing via the sea. So it's still very much happening. Of course, the government's had no control over the state, so it can't, you know, do anything to help any targeted minorities or any persecution of any groups. It can't even get back into the capital and control its own ministerial buildings, let alone the behavior of, you know, heavily armed groups who bear grudges.
Right. It's just incredible. And then, you know, like we talked about, or as you kind of mentioned there, or imply when you're talking about how close they're watching compared to how much they talk about it, it seems like, I mean, of course, what I'm trying to say is they don't talk about it very much. If they did start talking about it, that would probably just, you know, presage an invasion, another stage of intervention here. It's almost better ignored, it seems like, before the Americans come again and make it that much worse. But I know that's a pretty cynical take, but I couldn't see them making it better when, you know, Michael Hastings reported about Hillary, which I called it before he reported it, but her whole strategy with the Libya war in 2011 was just because America looked so bad for obviously backing the fascist military dictatorship in Egypt that the entire people seemingly rose up to overthrow, that they tried to confuse the issue by saying, well, look, in Libya, we're on the side of the people, protesters, versus the evil dictator, because it made for a simple headline for the Saturday morning newspaper, something for the American people to be confused as to whether America backs dictatorships in the region or not. And here was her chance to, as she said, get the Arab Spring off on the right foot from a public relations point of view by stabbing Gaddafi in the back after he'd come in from the cold back in 2003, that he'd been finally let back in and made his deal with George Bush and all that. And so it was simply, you know, a PR stunt, you know, like the Waco massacre. So nothing more than a PR stunt they pull off and create a catastrophe. So I don't know how President Hillary's going to come and clean up the mess, but I would rather, I guess, the American people just forget about it than get obsessed with it, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I mean, I think also a lot of the interest from sort of Western forces in the Libyan civil war was probably also motivated by the huge amount of oil that's in Libya. Libya is one of the largest oil producers in the whole of Africa. And those, you know, opportunities to make money out of that is pretty huge. Again, sort of similar ideas to why they intervened in Iraq, although I don't want to simplify things. But
right.
I think at the moment, another reason why the states simply can't get involved is because we're seeing an enormous proxy war happening in Libya. Like I said, we've got Egypt, Saudi, UAE on one side. On the other side, you've got Qatar and Turkey, who are supposedly supporting the Islamists and the militias. So if the America was to intervene, that's going to upset the balance of the region, considering Turkey is meant to be NATO's ally. And of course, you know, helping them along, or supposedly helping them along with their battle against ISIS and the Syrian regime in Syria and Iraq. So I think for the Americans, anything public, they possibly have learned their lesson, but anything public at the moment would stir a hornet's nest in the region when we're seeing all these proxy wars taking place in all these different countries as these superpowers, regional superpowers, back their different horses.
All right. Thank you very much, Belle. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
All right, y'all. That's Belle True. She's at the London Times and at foreignpolicy.com. This one is called A Ground Invasion of the Capital is Imminent. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com.